Game on.
Game on.
2FM.
And you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to talk about the very untimely death of John Olomou with Greg Feek, Shane Byrne and Tony Ward in a few minutes' time. Tony's also going to take us through his new book, 12 Feet Tall, which is out in all good bookshops at the moment. Sean Moran of the Irish Times on what next for Galway hurling after the resignation of Anthony Cunningham earlier this week. And we have Gary Murphy giving us an update on the Irish players hoping to make it through Q School as well. 51552 for your text. We'd love to hear from you at GameOn2FM on Twitter. And Alan Cawley is stuck in traffic at the moment, but is on his way into studio. She'll be here very soon. But Tony, I'm delighted to say, is with me, and you're very welcome.
Thanks, Hugh. Delighted to be here.
When I say the words to you, John Olomou, what comes into your head?
Iconic, legendary. I mean, he took the rugby world by storm. I think, like everybody, Hugh, when I woke up this morning, I just flicked on the telly, and the other way, you're kind of half-conscious, and I just saw, coming across the bottom of the screen, this thing, John Olomou, age 40, dies, rugby legend, and it just didn't register. Like, it kept going across, and it just didn't, because it was almost surreal seeing it there. I think, you know, he was... Like, I draw a comparison very much with Pelé in soccer. He had that kind of ambassadorial feel in recent times, the way he was developing. And I've no doubt that's the way it would have been going forward had he lived. But what an impact he had on the game. He took the game on a global level to new places entirely where it had never been before. I think... You know, and people have often said this, when you look at his physique and his size, people say had he been in Ireland, he would have probably ended up with the second row, and I've no doubt that that's true. But I think what impressed me more than anything, quite apart from his try-scoring ability and his pure strength, was his balance for a big man allied to his pace.
Yeah.
It was absolutely phenomenal.
You see, I was trying to describe to my five-year-old son this morning, you know, what it was that made John Olomou the player that he was. And sure, you can say, look at the size of him. He was a physical giant at that time, and there just wasn't anybody like him. But as you say, it was his ability to move at the speed at which he did and the grace at which he was able to do it that just separated him from everybody else.
It was extraordinary. And we all remember the obvious tries, the four against England, and particularly the one where he ran over my cat.
Poor old cat.
Yeah, I mean, they were amazing. But it was his balance in a distant... Like, he wasn't a sidestepper. He wasn't a... I always find it hard. Nicky Milner cutter. I always find it hard.
Scutter,
get that double barrel together.
Yeah.
Very different type of player, obviously.
Yeah.
He wasn't a sidestepper because he was a big man, but could he swerve? Like, it was just amazing the way he drifted in and outside guys and the way he brushed them aside. But that was a physical thing. He had such strength. He was just an extraordinary talent. I didn't have the privilege of meeting him, Hugh, sadly, but I'll tell you, he came across so well and he was so good for the image of rugby that he's a huge loss.
And I think, you know, looking at the game now, everybody has levelled out. I mean, there are centres that are as big as back row forwards, that are as big as second row forwards. So, you know, you just have everybody to play the game now. You need to be a certain physical size, really, bar a few exceptions. But him at the time, I remember when I was playing one of your old clubs, Greystones, and I was an under 12, and they had we played against a team, De La Salle Palmerston. They had a guy in their team who was 6'3" at 12 years of age and about 15 stone. And it was the equivalent. We had to put two lads on him just to take him down, Stephen Quinn, if you're listening. But, you know, he used to run half through any team at that age because he just was so much bigger than everybody else, and Olomou was the same.
But what about, you know, I mean, you do that at schoolboy level, underage, that's one thing.
That's what I mean,
but
as an adult.
He was doing it at adult level, at the highest level of the game. Like, it was just amazing. I heard Sean Fitzpatrick talking about him earlier on, I think it was to Greg, and he was just making that point that they watched him when Sean was captain of the All Blacks, and they were watching him play for New Zealand schools against the Australian schools. He scored four tries apparently in the game, and I remember him in the sevens when he came on the scene first, and it was the same thing. He was just a freakish talent. I think Will Carling once used that expression to describe him, but he meant it in the most respectful way.
Yeah.
He was a freak in ways, but what a talent, a skillful freak, for want of a better word.
A very sad day for the world of rugby, but equally, and more importantly, I suppose, for New Zealanders, and a former All Black international, now of course involved with the Irish coaching setup, Greg Feek, I'm delighted to say, is on the line. Hi, Greg.
How you doing, all right?
Listen, it's good to talk to you. I wish it was under better circumstances. Greg, I imagine a really sad day for rugby people and for New Zealanders in particular.
Yeah, there's been a lot of comments, a lot of stuff talked about Jonah, and it was certainly it's the third time this year for a lot of us involved in New Zealand rugby that one of our colleagues has passed away. So it was certainly another shock.
What was he like as a person, Greg? I mean, you played with him on the New Zealand team that came to Ireland in 2001. What was he like at that time?
Yeah, I had him in the World Cup as well, and he actually one of the things that I distinctly remember is the big heart he had, and how kind he was and how thoughtful he was, and underneath it all, he was actually a genuinely good bloke, and even to the point where when say for instance you said you could eat 3 burgers, he would try and impress you more and say he could eat 5, or he'd always try and outdo you, and it was almost he was trying to impress you, and we used to sort of talk about why is Jonah trying to impress us? He's done enough already, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was just the type of guy he was. He was really, really down to earth underneath all that as well, you know.
And I'm always curious, I suppose, about whether or not New Zealand fans held him in the same esteem as the rest of the world. I remember, you know, as a kid watching the All Blacks play, and I couldn't understand how every move or every call didn't result in Jonah Lomu getting the ball. And I wonder how New Zealanders felt about him.
Yeah, we all grew up. We grew up with him, you know. Like you say, he came on the scene at 18, 19 as an All Black, and he lived in Auckland, he lived in Wellington, he's in counties, and people got used to him. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
And got used to him doing his thing. Got used to him driving around in his car and music going, and being really friendly, and he always stopped to talk to people, and in the end, neighbours and stuff just got used to having the big guy around.
There was nobody like him at that time, and Tony spoke about the 95 World Cup. Obviously, he just exploded onto the scene, and, you know, it's kind of strange to try and describe it. I mentioned trying to describe it to my son this morning, you know, and he couldn't really get his hand around it. How was this guy so much bigger than everybody else? But that's just the way he was.
Yeah, and he'd been playing number 8 at school a bit as well, and played sevens, and to do what he did on the wing at such an early stage of his career, let alone, you know, all the skills and the stepping that you're talking about earlier, you know, he was certainly special, and he handled all that remarkably well, considering the attention he got when he was out of New Zealand. Yeah?
Were you guys, as teammates, aware that he was battling this illness, or when did it kind of come to light that actually, you know, he had serious problems with his kidney?
No, and that's the thing. Imagine if he didn't have his kidney. You know, how it actually just blows your mind as to what he would have really, what more he would have brought to the game. Well, none of us really knew. We all knew he was battling away, and you know, with a few things, but we didn't realise how serious it was. And until basically everyone found out, there was a couple of murmurings a few months beforehand, and he was you know, a close relationship with John May, who's your back doctor, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So you kind of put two and two together, you know.
Yeah, and as you say, I mean, to do what he did despite having to battle this condition, which by all accounts is quite debilitating, and obviously it ended his career in the end because he just couldn't continue to play with it. I mean, you just put all those things together and you realise what a legend he was of the game.
Yeah, and he, I felt, I think, was lucky that he was able to do what he did and carried on being a figurehead and ambassador for the game, and I think he's been massive around the world. It's been great to people. A lot of people that met him have walked away with a smile on their face, and I think you know, and they were saying that before today as well, you know, which is great. And I'll certainly look at him, remember him with fondness, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Greg, we really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us. Thanks to me, and I know it's been a tough day for all New Zealanders. Thanks so much for your time.
No problem. Cheers.
Cheers. Greg Feek there. Obviously, fond memories. Just have a listen to this, Tony, because one of my favourite memories.
So quickly, here is Jonah Lomu now. 18 stone of him thundering up over the 22. Lomu out to Little. Little's over for the try. It's going to be the first try for the All Blacks. And that was the first we've seen of the mighty Jonah Lomu. Now to Lomu. Lomu going for a charge for the line. Can they stop him? No, not this time they can't. And Lomu's over. This time he was irresistible. Bishop comes into midfield, a long pass to Lomu. Now it's inside to Cornfield. Cornfield to Lomu. Lomu going over the corner again for a second try. To Lomu again. Lomu. Oh, he's just away again. And he's just got Bell in front of him. He's still going. Oh, he's gone for another tackle. This is sensational running. He's still going, Lomu. He passes to Cornfield. And Cornfield has scored.
Yeah, created by Jonah Lomu. I mean, you know, How do you tackle a guy? How did you tackle a guy like that? I mean, you've come up against some big players in your time, but I mean, this guy was just a juggernaut. Like, and the further he got in his stride, the faster he got, and I'm sure the more difficult he was to stop.
Yeah. But you know, it was lovely. You just picking up what Greg said there. He was a wrecking ball, as you've just shown from the commentary there on the field, but the gentle giant off it. And I made reference to you, and I do it again today with Killian Shanley earlier on. I was talking about a documentary I saw, because it really registered with me this morning with Joost van der Westhuizen. He went to South Africa and he gave his all to that family when he was there. My point being, like, his condition was so bad himself, and he obviously knew that he was on dialysis. None of us knew how bad it was, and yet there he was giving his all for Joost van der Westhuizen and encouraging him and his family. I just thought, wow, what a man.
There was a fax sent to the New Zealand team, a famous story, before the 1995 Rugby World Cup final against South Africa by an anonymous Kiwi fan, and he said, look, remember guys, rugby is a team game, all 14 of you pass the ball to Jonah. And like that kind of came out, one of the famous stories around it. And incredibly, they didn't win that World Cup. I mean, there are stories of food poisoning and all that kind of stuff, which I'm sure the Kiwis would use. But one guy who did have the pleasure of trying to take him down a few times is Shane Byrne, former Ireland international, of course. Hey, Shane.
The pleasure.
The pleasure of tackling Jonah.
Yeah, it was a hell of an experience, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what was it like to play against it? You know, running out onto the pitch, give us an idea, Shane. You know, you look across and you see this guy, because I was trying to put into context, I suppose, that, you know, just the pure enormity of the guy in terms of, you know, his physical stature. What was it like running out playing against him?
Yeah, it was, you're aware, it was an Ireland game versus the Babas in Lansdowne, the old Lansdowne Road, and everybody was aware, like, forget about all the rest of the team who you're playing against. Everybody knew that that guy was on the park. And you just end up in a situation where you're aware where he is, you're aware he's tracking on the ball. And then it came around a moment in the game where he was right in front of me, running at me. So, look, you just decide you have to go tackle him. You have to go, you stick your head in, you hit him as hard as you possibly can. And as Tony was talking about, his coordination and his skill set was incredible. So he's down, he bumps you off, you go back a bit, you go back two or three steps, but you attack him again, and you end up hanging on to his ankle, praying to God that somebody comes along and jumps on his back, and then eventually helps you haul him down so it's not kicked off as a complete missed tackle. Yeah. But he was so impressive in everything that he did. As Tony was saying, that there was no one like him when he arrived on the scene. The shape, the size, the physique, like, we'd all seen big forwards playing, but the simple fact that he was out on the wing, there's been many people that have been compared to him, but I'm telling you, if this guy arrived on the scene now, yes, look, he wouldn't be brushing guys off. Guys are a little bit bigger, everyone's committed to the tackle now, but he would still be the superstar he ended up being,
because he was, Tony, the first real superstar of rugby. I mean, you talk about Michael Jordan in basketball, Maradona, and you mentioned Pele there before. Like, John Olomu, every kid in the world was talking about this guy after that 94 World Cup.
Yeah, they knew nothing about rugby.
No.
Probably not even the shape of the ball, but they knew who John Olomu was. Yeah. Just the name, it resonated with them. And he just hit the world stage with such impact. As Shane is saying there, like, what actually happened was, you'd actually have one guy trying to stop him, probably two, and then a third actually putting in the tackle. He just took players out of it. And then, of course, you had the type of Sonny Bill offload into the bargain as well. Well, it was just a complete package, but out in the wing.
Yeah, incredible. Shane, one of the texters just let us know, am I correct in thinking Peter Stringer came up against Lomu one day against Ireland, wide on the wing, and in the case of the Irishman, he quitted himself very well. I do remember, that was a bit of a tap tackle as well, wasn't it?
It was a tap tackle. He let him go past a little bit first and took care of business after that, as he did. But ironically, it was, and I've talked to some of the South Africans after it, the guys who were in the 95, it was Simon Gagan who was the first man to show how to tackle John Olomu. If you remember that Ireland game when he was running right and won the first games he played in that World Cup, Gagan came in and single-handedly came in, just sprinted full speed at his ankles and just knocked him down at the ankles. And sure, as we all know, that's what Small, the South African winger, did in the whole, in that final, just chopped him down at the ankles the whole time.
I'm always, you know, and again, you know, Greg kind of touched on this when we were talking to him before, Shane, but New Zealanders are such a proud rugby nation, and I do wonder, like, when someone like Lomu comes along, a superstar that takes all the credit and all the attention, like, I wonder, was there a little bit of the other guys going, yeah, you know, there's 14 other guys on the pitch here, or do they just let him have his moment?
Well, to be honest with you, you know, it was a bit like that, because, like, look, New Zealand, if it was in Ireland, we would all be looking, it'd be just like that funny fax that went in famously, everybody give the ball to Jonah, because you would have thought that that's the way it goes, but New Zealand weren't about that. And New Zealand lost games in that period when he was in his prime, and he didn't get the ball. When you're watching the games, he didn't get the ball as much as you thought he would have got it, because there was more to New Zealand than that. Ah, look, I think they appreciate what a team player he was. As Greg was saying, that, look, he was an integral part of the squad. He wasn't like a loner. An extremely shy guy. I got to meet him plenty of times after rugby, mainly at charity events. And a guy who the fame sat uncomfortably with, but he was perfectly nice, really, really chilled out guy, and he would have been just another part of that squad, which is incredible to think, as he would have been an absolutely epic star if he was in any other World Cup side.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Shane, thanks a million for your time and your memories. Appreciate it.
No worries.
Thanks a lot, Shane Byrne there. I have to... I did meet him once. I was working in 98FM with our former pal, Johnny Lyons, of course, resting in peace at the moment. And Johnny was interviewing Joan. He was coming in to do an Adidas sponsorship promotion. So Johnny got to interview him, and Dermot and Dave were on the breakfast show at the time, and they got 5-10 minutes with him. And the first question that Dermot Whelan asked John O'Loma was, did he ever get confused with Joanna Lumley? And I remember just the look on his face saying, who the hell are you talking about? And what sort of place am I in here? And the two lads, of course, were cracking up laughing. Anyway, we're going to move on, because I have 12 feet tall copy of your book here, and it's a great read, but I'm just curious as to why you wrote the book.
Oh, at this stage in life, I think it's funny, and I guess it's an age thing, Hugh, when you get older, but I think what's happened in the last few years with the, and I've seen a lot of people have made similar comments, that when you're confronted with the health issue that I was a few years ago, you begin to think very different about life, and you become very, very philosophical, maybe overly so. And I just thought, I did a book, as you know, way back when I retired.
Yeah, and I read it.
Yeah, yeah. The Good, the Bad, and the Rugby. And that tends to be the case when your career is over and you're looking back on it. Probably not the time to do it, because it's kind of halfway house, half time.
Okay.
That was the best part of a quarter of a century ago. And I just think that it's a better time now to be able to judge in a more substantive way my own career and my own life. And that's what I've tried to do. And the one thing that I'm at pains to emphasize, and I've said it to you, Hugh, a few times when we've been talking about this in the last few weeks, that it really isn't a T.W. whinge, you know, in any way, shape or form. And the reason I say that is, I was looking at the extracts in my own newspaper the weekend before last, and because they're in isolation, I kind of thought, oh God, is that the perception people are going to have? But it's not. It's a human story, trying to embrace the last few years, what was involved, and looking back in my career in totality. And maybe I am still angry about certain things that did happen. Obviously, the Australia thing.
Yeah.
And not so much even being dropped. Yeah, that hurt, but it was just the way it was handled at the time. So I think I'm trying to look at that in a more, I don't know if objective way is what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
But certainly in a more human way.
You see, you're born the same year as my dad, right? And my dad and my mum would have grown up watching you play. And, you know, from my earliest days, when I first picked up a rugby ball, this Campbell Ward rivalry was such a feature in our house, because we loved rugby and they would have loved watching you and playing for Greystones and followed your career all over. And, you know, my parents would have always asked the question, you know, how did Tony feel when he was dropped in Australia that time? And it was, they thought, so unfair, even regardless of how well Ollie Campbell played in that tour and went on to play for Ireland, they could never get their head around the decision to drop you at that time. And so this book, I suppose, for a lot of those people, and there are, I'm sure, thousands and thousands, answers a lot of those questions about how you would have felt.
Yeah, and that was the difficulty. I think what probably got me at the time, Hugh, wasn't, I never mind being dropped. I was dropped many times subsequently.
Sure.
And for Ollie, and I have to say as well, and I've emphasised this in the book, Ollie was absolutely superb on that tour. He was player of the tour. We won the series. And if the end justifies the means, which is a very fair argument, then the decision taken was the right one. What I found difficult, and that's what I'm looking back on overall, is that it absolutely wrecked me as a player in terms of confidence at the time. It was very hard trying to build that up again. And the point I'm trying to make is that I was playing well at the time. And that's what I found hard to understand. And no one explained to me who
you were. You were the player of the Five Nations. You had won 3 of the 4 Man of the Match awards for that particular season. Ireland starting out half. Accolades and awards everywhere at your feet. Rugby Writers Player of the Year. And yet, with no explanation, you go to Australia, and for the first test, you are dropped for a guy who has been struggling with injury for the previous 2 seasons. And there is no explanation.
There was no explanation to me at the time, and that's what I found particularly difficult, because I played in the game before, I can't remember the series of games, I think it was the second game against the ACT Brumbies,
and I
played well in that game. In other words, I knew going out that I had to make sure that my form was maintained throughout that, and that at least I managed to do. It was just, you know, and I've said this a few times, the players today, Hugh, when they're... like before the World Cup, when they were out in Carton House, they either get the text or the phone call. The text, as you know, is the green light. The phone call is the red light.
Listen, here's what.
You know, here's why you're not.
Sure.
I never got that.
No.
And that's my point. And it's the game has changed now, I like to think, dramatically. But certainly for me, I found that particularly frustrating at the time. Very, very difficult. And also, I think, being so far away from home, because bear in mind, back then, we didn't have means of communication.
Sure.
So you felt very isolated. So I think it was all those things coming in together. But the bottom line was, no one really explained to me why I was dropped, and I'm sure it was justified in their minds, but I never knew, and to this day.
And you had a captain of the team, Fergus Lattery, that barely spoke to you afterwards. You had a manager, Jack Coffey, who just point blank refused to talk to you for the tour, and a coach, Noel Murphy, who made some kind of small effort, but nothing really as far as he should have to justify a decision like that. And you write in the piece that, you know, a young fly half took a noon flight to Australia from London in May 1975 and never came back. And that, to me, just is really sad to read something like that, because you were a young guy with hopes and dreams of playing at the highest level for your country. And it was just taken away from you.
Yeah, it's. And I don't want to sound bitter and angry at this stage.
But you have every right to be. I know, but you have every right to be. I would.
Forward. But it's beginning to sound like the whinge. I don't want it to sound, but you're right. It's just the frustration of feeling that the potential that was there was never fulfilled, and today's professionals get that opportunity. I think that's the biggest plus of being a pro. Mm-hmm. Whatever about the money and being paid for the game you love and all that, I think getting the opportunity to fulfill whatever God-given talent you have. And I just felt that dissipated when I was out there, and I'm not too sure it was my fault in the circumstances. And I just like to think that were I a coach, a manager, captain, whatever, I would handle it differently. I'd like to think. And maybe that's the bugbear I have to this day about it. So I guess at this point in my life, given, as I explained to earlier on, I feel this was the right time to address it.
Absolutely. And I suppose, look, we're not going to dwell on it a huge amount more, but, you know, it's in the book. The attitude of the IRFU towards you at that time, based on what, you know, now nobody would bat an eyelid. That picture that came in, you know, was taken by the media. And nowadays, as I said, nobody bat an eyelid. But it smacks to me that, you know, this was a conservative time in Ireland, not just for Irish rugby, that it was obviously going back to Catholic dominated Ireland, that, you know, everyone had to kind of just be subservient almost and please and thank you for everything, that, you know, nobody deserved anything, and in fact if you felt you deserved something, we were going to take you down a peg or two. And everything that happened in the run up to that, by not allowing you to accept awards which you were entitled to accept, by their letters that they insisted on writing you asking you to explain yourself for perfectly reasonable different things that arose, all of that and the decision to drop you leads to me that actually it was a form of bullying that happened, and they actually directly targeted you.
Yeah, I can't deny any of that, because that is what happened. I mean, they used to meet once a month, and I'd regularly get these letters, and I guess if I'm honest, I had a couple of moulds in there, a couple of friends of mine who were actually on the IRFU committee,
sure.
And they were keeping me up to speed of what was being said, and I knew what was coming before it even landed on my door. But it was ridiculous when you look back, as you say, and thankfully, Hugh, as you well know, because you deal with them, the IRFU have changed dramatically in the interim.
Yeah.
We have Philip Brown running it now, and he's taken into a new age completely, different attitude, much more transparent, and it is a professional age. But you're right, back then, and we accepted that. That's the way it was, and it was fear. I mean, they ruled with an iron fist, and I guess I was one of the victims of it in that time.
The college years, I'm just trying to push myself back, you know, I was down and playing for Waterford IT, I think on the seconds there, and yet you, first year in college, Gary Owen, second year, Munster, Ireland, and the progression right through. I mean, that must have been an incredible time in your life. And it comes through in the book and you talk about it.
Yeah, it was great. But I was lucky too, Hugh. I love Limerick. You know, I have a passion for the city from the time that I first went there. And the fact that all that happened down there. And also, it was a great time in Limerick sport. I mean, I played a bit of soccer, as you know, as well. And we had the Owen Hand years then as well, which was the golden period of Limerick. Limerick United with the FAI Cup League, 3 years in Europe and all that. Plus, I was in a great Gary Owen side probably the greatest side they ever had, even better than the side they had in the early 90s when they won the AIL. We had a particularly good side back in the 70s, and it was Munster beating the All Blacks and winning the Grand Slam and all that. So I was lucky to be involved in a really good period. And as you say, it coincided in college. Without doubt, Hugh, the 4 years in the University of Limerick, or NCP as it was then, were the happiest years of my life and the most fulfilling. And I look back with the fondest memories on my time at Plassey, without a doubt.
Yeah. So can I just, it's been a tough couple of years for you, the last couple of years.
It has, yeah. It's been an interesting journey.
Has it shaped you? Has it changed you as a person, do you think?
You know, thanks for asking me that. I actually think it has, and I'm probably not the one to answer that, but I do feel a little more mellow in terms of my own personality, because I can be quite serious. I am a worrier.
Yeah.
I try not to worry as much as I did. And the other great thing, and this is very cliched, you really do find out who your true friends are. And I have a lot of great friends, I have to say, beyond my family. I've really...
Including Ollie Campbell.
Friends. Including Ollie. Ollie has been right throughout my career. And that's just the nature of the beast. Anyone who knows Ollie knows what he's like. He's just a very caring... In fact, I've often told the story, and I'll do it very quickly again now.
Go on, yeah.
Whenever we used to play against each other, you know, and you come up to... particularly when it would come to either a Munster-Leinster game or a final trial. And in college at the time, obviously, I used to do a lot of work on psychology and mental preparation, all that sort of thing. And I'd worked so hard in building up in my own mind, bordering on hatred. Like, I wouldn't want to eyeball him before the game or have anything to do with him, just to ignore him. Mm. And you do that all week and be preparing for it, and you're going to really take this guy apart on the day. And out you go onto the field, and as you're changing ends, as you know, happens in rugby, you'll be running by him, you know, they tap you on the butt or on the head and say, good luck today, Wardy.
Yeah.
Meaning it. Now, there was no reverse psychology at work or anything, just the nature of the man. And that made it more difficult, you know, not to, unlike, say, the co-Ovette rivalry or even Stuart Barnes and Rob Andrew in our own game. It was difficult, but that's the nature of the guy. He's just a lovely guy.
I mean, you mentioned the worrying side to your personality. Do you think that because you grew up in a house predominantly full of women, and obviously your dad died very young, and now with your three daughters as well, I mean, women have surrounded you your entire life, and I would put forward, I'm going to get absolutely killed for this, that women tend to worry more than men. Do you think that is just, again, being a huge shaping influence in your personality?
Sadly, yes. I do, yeah. Obviously, I was ballycoddled when I was younger. I think I'm probably too sensitive for my own good. I've always been. I'm probably a little bit too honest as well.
But I really like that about you.
I appreciate that, Hugh. It's probably got me into trouble a lot of times.
Yeah.
You know, maybe naive beyond what I should be. But there's no doubt the female influence has always been huge in my life. And I have to say, I've enjoyed that and still do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, I've just a text in from Willie Dawson here, who I have to confess is my uncle, as you well know. And he said, Tony, you're a great player and are a great guy. By being dropped made you no less of a player, that you were glad to have played with you and against you a couple of times. Regards, Willie.
A hell of a winger too, I can tell you.
A centre, centre as well.
Centre for Lansdowne.
Yeah. He did actually. Yeah, 3 cup medals. It keeps reminding me of it. Look, in terms of, you know, the perspective that, you know, dealing with illness has given you on life, I mean, I asked you, has it changed you? I mean, can you release some of the worries now? Can you remind yourself, look, there are bigger things in life. The small stuff actually isn't worth my time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's how it is. And you know, something like this morning, and even in even with Jonah waking up to that, but even you in the last few weeks, like, Johnny Lyons, who you mentioned, as I was doing it, I'm thinking, you know, will I go ahead with this? And then something like that suddenly hits you with an aneurysm or something so simple. And suddenly, you know, he's gone. And there's been a few, like a great friend of mine, Chris Naidu, in the last few weeks, a young lad I used to teach in school, Nicky Arnold. And it's just life, you know, these things happen and you just don't know what the future holds. So, yeah, and I know I'm probably boring people out there because I'm this philosophical old geezer in there, but it does give you a different perspective on life and treasure what we've got while we've got it.
Absolutely, because not everyone comes through it.
For sure.
Yeah. Listen, Tony, it's been a pleasure. The book is 12 feet tall. Tony Ward, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Hugh.
Get your game face on.
Game on 2FM.
You're very welcome back. 51552 for your text messages. Now, this week on the show, we're counting down to the Air Grid International Rules Series. This Saturday, of course, Ireland's best Gaelic footballers in the country taking on Australia under lights at Croke Park. Official sponsors of the game, Air Grid, have very kindly given us some nice prizes to give away this week. We've got a family set of 4 tickets to give away tonight and tomorrow and Thursday as well. We've got one over overall prize of a family set of four tickets with accommodation included on the night. Plus, to make it a really memorable prize, one of the children from the family will get to be the mascot at the match as well. All the details coming up very, very soon. Just a couple of texts in on Tony Ward, who obviously, as mentioned, his book 12 Feet Tall is out at the moment. Hey guys, great stuff tonight. Really enjoying the show. Looking forward to reading Tony's book. Top guy, great player, and a great corner taker for Limerick United in the 1982 FAI Cup final. Regards, Carl Grace. Yeah, and I never even got to touch on that, Carl. The fact that Tony obviously had to combine the soccer with the rugby for so many years, and nobody does that now. But obviously, it's all in the book. Thanks for your text. Tony, great guy, a great skill set. Maybe less for the team player than they say, than Ollie Campbell, but still a special player, says Barry in County Cork. Thanks for that, Barry. Alan Cawley, how are you?
Evening, Hugh.
You made it through the traffic.
Yeah, traffic's bedlam out there, but here I am.
Listen, John Olomou obviously passed away this morning, and he, because of his illness, never thought he was going to be able to have kids, and he ended up having two boys, a 5 and a 6-year-old, and desperately sad for them to lose their dad at 40 years of age. And I'm wondering, as you were walking around Paris on Friday night with two kids back at home, yourself and Cathy, and all of a sudden all hell breaks loose, were you thinking, oh my God, we just need to get home?
Yeah, I suppose, to be fair, Hugh, that is your first thought. And anybody who knows out there, any dads or any mums who has kids, that's the first thing that comes into your mind straight away. And we were trying to keep it from them, because obviously you're ringing home to the parents and they're on the other end of the phone, and obviously the kids are running around the granny's house, whatever. And you don't want to say too much, because Mia is at an age where she picks up on everything as well. And then they obviously have the Sky News on, or BBC News, or whatever news channel they're watching, trying to get as much information as possible. So they're trying to kind of keep her away from that as well. So that was the kind of the game we were playing, in the sense that you're trying to keep them away from that. But of course, it's your first thought, and it was just, it was surreal, really, Hugh, the fact that obviously you knew I was heading over there, and we went over for a weekend away, a nice little break, because we had a long kind of, the season had finished last week, the football, so it was, we just wanted to get away for a break. She has to put up with enough football. But thankfully, I dragged her to a football match on Friday night, being the Ireland match over there, because I wanted to see that.
Well, this is it. So just tell, I mean, Cathy normally would kind of go hunt out places for you to walk around, restaurants and bars and stuff like that, and you said, look, I have to see this match, so we're going to the Irish bar where I know it's going to be on. And you were out of harm's way there.
That was basically it, yeah. The hotel we were staying was just off the Champs-Élysées, and luckily enough, Andrew, who knew a girl over there, Ciara, who was in this part of the O'Sullivan group, the pub over there, because
I think we'd
done the show there a couple of years ago. So we got in touch with Ciara before I went over, because obviously I knew the match was on and I wanted to see the match. And thankfully, Ciara got back to Andrew and sorted out that the match has definitely been shown. But it was being shown, luckily enough, in the pub just around the corner from where the hotel was. So that was fine. We arrived there Friday. You're obviously travelling around. We were up down the Champs-Élysées. We were up the Arc de Triomphe at literally 5 o'clock that evening, Hugh. And as you say, 3.5 hours later, all hell is breaking loose. So we went down to the pub, because Cathy normally, as I say, sources out restaurants or whatever. So we would have been further out, I presume, in the city, only for the match. Went down to watch the match. But then as the fog descended on the game, I opened up Twitter to try and follow updates on Twitter of exactly how the match was going. And I seen the first kind of hint of this stuff breaking out. And at that point, I said, let's get out of here quick.
What was it like? I mean, what was it like over there from what you saw and from the people that you were able to meet? I mean,
It turned out we were only 2 blocks away. We were in the 8th arrondissement, and I think all this stuff was going off in the 10th and the 11th, the first attack. But we thought it was just that at the time. And it was only, as I say, we went straight back to the hotel. So we were like 3 or 4 minute walk, thankfully, got straight back to the hotel. So we were back in the hotel at maybe 9, half 9, whatever time it was. And then we only seen the extent of exactly what was taking place, and that there was multiple attacks. And then everybody started ringing and texting. And it was, Hugh, because normally, like, you're in Ireland and you're looking at this from afar, maybe, and obviously you're seeing how bad it is and how desperately sad it is. But to be actually there, it was quite frightening, to be honest with you. It really was.
Of course it was. I mean, yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. As you say, you look at these things and you're able to put it into context because it's removed from where you are. So there's no immediate threat. And even when people say France and Ireland are so close and it's a Europe crisis now, you know, that they have to deal with, but to be actually there and to be 2 blocks away.
Of course, and it's something that would never, ever enter your head.
No, of course
never
it wouldn't.
In a million years. As I say, we were walking down the Champs-Élysées, there were thousands of people around. Atmosphere was great. We were in great form. You're obviously away for the weekend. And for this to happen, yeah, it was just, obviously we woke up Saturday then, and Friday seemed to go on forever because you couldn't sleep. Like, people ringing, texting, that was going on for hours. You were trying to follow it there. And then You couldn't get a sleep eventually when we were trying to go to sleep. So when we woke up Saturday, we did venture out a bit. We stayed by the hotel, but we ventured out a bit. But it was just the complete opposite of what we experienced on the Friday.
But for the security of the Stade de France, and I've been to so many games for the Six Nations over the last few years to watch France play. And but for this, every time you go in there, they search your bag. I mean, you have to open your bag, they go through the contents and anything that's suspicious, whatever. But for the security there, one of the suicide bombers would have got inside the stadium and God knows what had happened in
well,
there.
Well, I dare to think of the consequences here because, as you say, this, the fact that one of these lads or whatever the word that had the ticket to get in and to think of the damage that would have been caused, it would have been absolute. And again, only for the match, probably because that game was on, and obviously with me loving the football, I probably would have maybe sourced out a ticket to see France and Germany. I could have, you know, because you're not far from the Stade de France. So look, it's all ifs and buts, but thankfully we're home and everything's fine.
Listen, to change tack, 6 months ago you and I were just dismissing the chance that Ireland would get within an ass's roar of Euro 2016, and all of a sudden, what's after happening?
Yeah, and I think, to be fair,
it's incredible.
Like, I know we kind of laugh and joke we were dismissing it out of hand, but we had good reason to dismiss it.
Sure.
Because the campaign, and anybody that says the campaign was great, they'd be lying to you, because it wasn't. It was a mixed bag, Hugh. And I suppose, that in fairness to Martin O'Neill, the one thing he always said was, judge me at the end of the campaign, not after each match. And that's a fair comment from his point of view as well, I suppose.
We're going to write that down and pin it to the wall there.
Yeah.
Hold your fire.
But in modern day football especially, that just doesn't happen. And people are judged, teams are judged. We see it in the Premiership. People writing players and teams off literally week in, week out. You win 1 week, you're the hero. You lose, people want you out the door, whatever. And in fairness, I think since the turnaround really was, that Germany game must have gave them huge confidence, and because no one gave us a prayer going into that. And to be fair to Martin O'Neill, I think he was trying. I know we were giving out about team selections each match, and he was being a bit cautious. But to be fair to him, maybe he was trying to find his best 11. And looking at the team the other night and the last couple of games, he's kind of come across an organisation, a shape. He obviously is Wesley included. He has Whelan and McCarthy sitting now, which a lot of teams tend to do because you have two holding midfielders. And he kind of lets the rest of them get on. Hendrick has been a big plus. I think he's done very well since he's come in. And it's brilliant. I was at the match Friday night and it was absolutely brilliant to see the atmosphere. It was something similar to what we've seen with Germany, and we were hoping that wouldn't be a once-off. And thankfully it wasn't, because they were brilliant on Monday night against Bosnia.
And for me, the same. I just, you know, I remember the first game in Germany away, obviously we were completely outplayed and managed to grab that last minute draw. There was something very different about the Germany home performance, just an incredible effort from everybody involved. But again, I thought it was another level up again against Bosnia on Monday night, because the team just played with a passion and a commitment, yet this incredible control. They refused to be sucked in by any of the stuff that was going on with the Bosnians, who were losing their heads all over the place. And I just thought, this is it, this is actually football that we want to be a part of and one can relate to as Irish people.
Exactly, and I think, as you rightly say, Hugh, that's what we expected from Martin O'Neill's team from day one. Now, maybe it's taken him a bit of time to get his point across, but we've always seen Martin O'Neill as such an infectious character on the sideline, kicking every ball. His team's been so motivated, so passionate.
Maybe he had to learn the lessons, though.
And in fairness, maybe it's taken him, as I say, it's taken him a bit of time to get that point across to the players. But certainly, obviously coming off the back of the Germany game, the confidence they would have gained from that, and they look like lads who, as you say, stepped up a notch. The likes of Brady, Hendrick have taken a lot of confidence from that, and looking at them the other night, I think they have stepped up a little bit, and hopefully it bodes well for the Euros, because I was looking at the pots last night. Obviously we're seeded in pot four, but I wouldn't have too much fear about European football and some of the teams.
No.
Obviously the likes of Spain and Germany are your top notch boys, but bar those, like even England, and
give us England
and
France, you wouldn't be afraid of France after watching them last night.
It's a much of a muchness to teams, Hugh, it really is. And I think a lot of teams will look at pot four and they'll be the team. Ireland will be the team that won't want in pot four.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to take a very quick break. We've got Sean Moran from the Irish Times as well. What next for Galway Hurling and Anthony Cunningham?
Get your game face on.
Game on 2FM.
Okay, now this week on the show, as I said, we're counting down to the Airgrid International Rules game this Saturday. Ireland's best Gaelic footballers against Australia under lights at Croke Park. It's one time where county rivalry is put aside and fans from all over the country get behind the Ireland team. Airgrid's, much like the GAA, operate right across the country, and as official sponsor of the International Rules, want you to be there this Saturday. They've given us a family set of four tickets to the game to give away tonight. All you have to do to be in with a chance to win is to answer this simple question. Who was the first Irishman to win the Brownlow medal? Who's the first Irishman to win the Brownlow medal? Text your answer to 51552 along with your name. We'll have a winner before the end of the show tonight.
Galway on the lookout for a new senior hurling manager after the resignation of Anthony Cunningham earlier this week. Sean Moran, GA correspondent with the Irish Times, is on the line. And Sean, I suppose, you know, your column today makes the point that I think a lot of people would agree with, and that it's hard not to think that Anthony Cunningham was hard done by in all of this.
Well, I think when you look at something like this, when it happens, it's so divisive within a county, you know, between the clubs in the administrators and, you know, keep the thing going all year round. Mm. Players on whose time such huge demands are placed, you know, during the season and from the beginning of the year on, and also for managers who, you know, all of the above in terms of the efforts that's put in. And I think probably where the sympathy for Anthony Cunningham comes is more in how all of this unfolded rather than, I suppose, the nuts and bolts of the matter, which are that, you know, he did 4 years with the county, got them to two All-Ireland finals, including one which went to a replay, and just came up short on both occasions. So, you know, I suppose you could make the argument, and certainly obviously the players have made that argument, that it's time to, you know, try something new. I think where the sympathy for him is that, you know, on the one hand, if you were looking at matters on the field, you'd say that although it was a familiar end result for Galway, you know, losing a final, which I think was their sixth since they last won in All-Ireland this year, that the team was a good bit different from the one in 2012. And as we brought through a number of the younger players, the sort of the emerging players, and that you could say that was, the, you know, progress was being made. Now, you can't in these circumstances circumvent the fact that the players will have the ultimate say in this. Now, it mightn't please everyone that is the case, but when you think that this is an amateur game, your players aren't on contract. All that players commit to do, they do voluntarily in terms of their time. Mm-hmm. And if they make a decision that they feel they'd be better served by going in a different management direction, there's not really very much you can do about it. And so they're the basic facts of the matter. I think the way in which Anthony Cunningham's reappointment was rushed through by the county committee did him no favours, particularly when it was clear that there were still problems with the players in the panel, and you know, that served to aggrieve the players further and cause, you know, an entrenchment all around. And I think that one thing about Anthony Cunningham that didn't get an awful lot of publicity was that it would be untrue, according to my information, to say that he had deliberately tried to, if you like, railroad through an appointment for himself when he was aware that the players didn't want him. And I don't think that any manager would do that. I think, you know, that the game is up. I think what he thought in his mind was happening was there were problems that were going to be resolved, or sort of chance of being resolved. But that situation, that process got caught up in other events, including the unwise decision to try and rush through his reappointment, and then all that flowed from that, which was that the hardening of attitudes within the county, the fact that the situation then didn't you know, ameliorate in any way. You could make the argument fairly, you know, that at that stage, as that situation got worse and worse, that maybe he should have stepped aside in those circumstances. But I suppose everyone, when these sort of situations become confrontational, everyone digs in, and, you know, in the end of it all, there's really no winners.
From a player's perspective, I mean, you know, there obviously are bigger issues here than just losing the final. And am I right in thinking that the players will say they got to a final in spite of what they felt were huge obstacles in terms of Anthony's style of management?
Yeah. Look, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about that. I don't think anyone's saying that, you know, that it all stands or falls by what happened in the All-Ireland final, though clearly if Galway had won the All-Ireland, it would be slightly different. But I don't think that the argument from the players has been, we lost an All-Ireland final, therefore it's your fault. And it's a matter of it's a matter of public knowledge at this stage, you know, that the players had expressed unhappiness back after the league, which concluded so disappointingly for Galway in defeat by Waterford in the quarterfinal, that there was a sort of a summit meeting at that stage where, you know, the management agreed to look at certain things and players agreed to look at their input in that. But I suppose what happened then over the summer was that Galway had one of their better summers, as things turned out. And Galway's summers tend to be extremes. You know, they're either flying it, or, you know, going all the way to a final, or they're playing disappointingly and going out relatively early in the championship. But there are a couple of good performances, you know, against Cork and Tipperary. So I suppose from the point of view of those who feel like Anthony Cunningham that the management was going somewhere, that there was progress, there was evidence for that as well. But the players as a group clearly felt that no, we've done this for 4 years and we want to do something different. And I think despite a lot of attempts to characterise the players' votes as being basically unduly influenced by older players, yeah. And you know, who knows, that may or may not be true. Certainly there are a lot of younger fellas in that panel. The fact remains that in a secret ballot, the vote of no confidence went through 26 votes to 6 in an independently supervised election. So I don't think there can be any doubts about what the players' intentions were in relation to this, and that was their point of view. Now, my essential point in all of this is that although, you know, you can make arguments on either side, that ultimately in these situations of conflict between players and management, you can get new management, but you won't generally get new players, and so that it generally only has one outcome, and that's what's happened in this case.
Yeah, and that was my next point. I mean, ultimately the lesson here is that, you know, when players take this kind of stance as a group, that they will win out. I mean, even look at, you mentioned, you know, Limerick situation, Justin McCarthy today, your piece there, but ultimately, you know, he had to go as well. Do you think it's right that the players have this kind of power, or is it just an inevitable situation, you know, in a sport like GAA, where, as you say, they're not on contract, so they can pretty much do what they like?
That's essentially it. I mean, you have to be, I suppose, neutral on the subject of whether these are well-founded, complaints, or whether the reservations about management are justified. And this is one of the big arguments within Galway, particularly within the Galway. The other county committee, hurling committee, and that they were aggrieved that they didn't really see why Anthony Cunningham should have to go, on the basis of what had happened. But you know, the point there, and you echo it yourself, it's that kind of irrelevant, because you know, if the players have decided they'll be better off with new management, you can be the best manager in the world, and if that decision has been made, there's no real way to get around it. And the irony is that's particularly true of an amateur sport, because you know, there is no, everything is done by consensus. There's no contractual obligations on anyone involved, and there's no real way of getting around it. Now, I think from the point of view of a well-administered county, and you know, the county administration, and in this case, I think should have done better in terms of how it was handled. But I think it is up to county officers to basically know what's going on within a panel and to take on board reservations that exist amongst players, make a judgment call as to whether these can be satisfactorily addressed or not. But to try and avoid this sort of confrontation, because this sort of confrontation, we've seen it. You mentioned Limerick there. I mean, it's happened in Cork, yeah, on a number of occasions over the last 15 years, that there can't really be any other outcome. And we saw it only, you know, running parallel to this in the autumn with the Mayo team, where, you know, they took made a similar call on their new management, yeah, of 1 year. And in that case, I think probably the writing was seen on the wall a lot quicker, and everyone acted in accordance with the likely outcome. Whereas it was let run in the case of Galway, which I don't think helps the situation certainly in the long term.
Do you think then that, you know, just finally, that the players should have any role in the process of trying to find a successor? Then, I mean, if they're ultimately the group that will hold any new manager to account, should they be consulted even on any small form with choosing a successor?
Well, I think what happens, I mean, my instinctive reaction to that is no, because you're putting a manager in charge of them, and the manager will decide how they're managed. But if you're being realistic, you can't, as has happened in the past in Cork, put a manager in charge that you're pretty sure the players won't play for, because that's self-defeating in the end. And I know where you're coming from in relation to this question, that, you know, might you not as well just to hand over the reins of management to the players? And I don't think that's good governance either within a county. But I do think that you have to pay attention to what the reservations are. Sure. Within a playing group. And to be fair, although we've seen two high profile incidents this autumn, and it has happened, you know, over the past 15 years, we were saying, it's not that common an occurrence that has happened. Certainly not in this very high profile, public manner. I'm sure there are within county boards back channel communications which establish, you know, what the views would be on certain people. But you know, as well as that, there has to be a reasonable assessment within counties of what's possible and what isn't. You know, that you have to. And counties find this to be difficult as well. You know, you have to take on managers who can implement an effective management strategy within the budget available within any given county. And good managers bring on board players with them. I think the problem probably more occurs after a couple of years or so, when people start to wonder would they be better off under new management and that. And I think the job of administrators in those situations is to be sufficiently aware to be able to anticipate problems on the ground, and then to act decisively when they arise, to resolve the issue before it becomes, you know, a kind of a public spectacle, as has happened in the cases we're talking about.
Okay, listen, Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
No problem. Yeah.
Sean Moran there. 24 teams through to the Eurofinals, and from that, only 8 out after the pool stage. What an absolute joke. Fans won't be long getting fed up with this SHYT, Tony and Shankill. And a lot of people enjoyed our interview with Tony Ward. If you want to meet Tony and get a copy of the book signed 12 Feet Tall, a few book signings coming up in Easton's on Patrick Street in Cork on Saturday the 28th at 1 o'clock, and Easton's Dundrum Shopping Centre in Dublin on December the 5th at 1 o'clock, and on Saturday the 12th of December, Tony will be in O'Mahony's. Frank O'Mahony will look after you in O'Connell Street in Limerick at 3 o'clock. Our winner of the 4 family tickets to the International Rules game this Saturday is Trish Gavin from Temple Tui in Thurles. Good luck to you. And we'll leave you with this text. Richard Wallace said of tackling John Olomou, "How do I tackle him? Wait until he's running past and bite his toes." Thanks for that, Julian Lee. Okay, sorry to Louise Bishari. We're mad over time. News is on the way. And Louise.